there. This is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have with us Mary Graybar. Mary is a resident fellow at the Alexander Hamilton Institute for the Study of Western Civilization and the founder of the Dissident Prof Education Project. She has taught at different universities, including Emory University, where I have been. And she's been published in many different journals, the City Journal, American Greatness, Academic Questions. Our topic today is a book that she's written that just come out from Renyery Publishers. It's called Debunking Howard Zinn, Exposing the Fake History That Turned a Generation Against America. Mary, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Mary, I think your subtitle might be a little off. Turned a Generation Against America. Aren't we at two generations now?
Yeah, actually.
the book, Howard Zinn. Well, maybe I should ask you just to give us a little introductory material here. You know, I was reading just in the Claremont Review of Books, the recent issue, an article by Alan Gelzo. And Alan says in there that something called the Zinn Education Project, which is a project, a group devoted to the promotion and promulgation of Howard Zinn's work, has 300,000 followers on social media. Have you heard of this project?
Oh yeah, I write about it. I didn't know that they had so many followers on social media, but I'm not surprised.
That's pretty good, 300,000, which tells you where Howard Zinn stands today. So why don't you just begin to tell us who was Howard Zinn? Maybe some of our listeners might not have actually heard of Howard Zinn before, even if they might see his influence in different places. Who was Howard Zinn?
Well, Howard Zinn was born in 1922. He was a member of the Communist Party. He grew up in Brooklyn. His parents were Russian Jewish immigrants, and his family wasn't too successful. When he was a teenager in the 1930s, the Communists came into Brooklyn, which was the epicenter of recruitment. And they recruited him, they talked to him, and he writes in his autobiography that after talking to them and after attending a demonstration where he supposedly was knocked unconscious by a policeman, he realized that all history is a history of the struggle of classes. So he saw everything through the lens of, Karl Marx. He worked on loading docks. He served in World War II. He got his PhD in history from Columbia University. And in 1956, with his dissertation not written yet, he was hired at Spelman College in Atlanta. That is a small Christian school for Black women. And so he came down and he did not like what the school was doing, not only in terms of its politics, but also in the rules that it had, such as daily chapel attendance, curfews, dress codes.
So as a good communist, young communist in the 1930s, he might have been culturally Jewish, but was he an atheist?
Yeah, he was an atheist, and I should add that he was a member of the Communist Party from the late 1940s until 1953.
So he was a card-carrying member.
Well, no one's found the card.
Okay, but not just a fellow traveler. He wanted to be in the party. At least he has said he wanted to be in the party.
Well, he taught at a communist school in Brooklyn. And the informers, to the FBI, said things that strongly indicate that he was a party member. Probably the foremost authority on that is Ron Radosh. And he, in an article in the Weekly Standard, confirmed that Howard Zinn was a member of the Communist Party. And that's from going through his 500-page FBI file, as well as comparing it to his own FBI file, because he had been a member for a year or two while he was young.
And he was, even in the late 40s, early 50s, when he was still in his 20s, he came to the attention of the FBI.
Yes, he did. You know, you're teaching at a school teaching Karl Marx, you know, a school that's run by the CPUSA. There are other people that say they've seen you at meetings. You know, he did attract the attention. And there were so many people who said that he promoted communism, at, you know, at the loading dock where he worked. He was seen teaching. He was seen at meetings. He was trying to recruit people on trains. So I think we could be pretty confident that he was a member. But like many communists of the time, he officially dropped his membership so he could infiltrate the institutions. And the year 1956, when he went to Spelman, was a crisis year for the communists. It was a low point. And so their new strategy was to go into the institutions, especially colleges and schools. And so, you know, Spelman College at the time had a its first black and first male president, and probably Zinn looked good on paper. You know, here he is getting his PhD from Columbia. He's a World War II vet. And Spelman College was trying to recruit more PhDs. But anyway, he was fired by that same president for insubordination, for leading students on dangerous protests, for riling them up, getting them to defy the administration. And there's a whole story about that that I have in one chapter. There was a lot of back and forth because he was, you know, just fired and given a year's pay and, you know, told to, you know, vacate the premises. He fought that, but Albert Manley came back and threatened him with a morals charge. He was quite popular with the young ladies there. And I got that from a couple of the biographies that have been written about him. But he soon landed on his feet. He got a job at Boston University.
So yeah, this and we can say everyone in the early 60s who had a PhD got a job. This was the great golden age when the undergraduate population exploded and universities needed to hire a lot of teachers to handle, because the GI Bill and all the baby boomers coming into college afterwards. And so he didn't have to be a scholar, a published scholar, in order to get a job at a school like Boston University that did have some desire to have published scholars. And so he probably, well, I guess he wanted to go back north.
Well, he had made some connections because he spent a year at Harvard in an East Asian Studies Institute, and he wrote a paper promoting communist China. So I think he made some connections up there in Boston, and you know, was hired. So, but that was one of the things too. You know, when Albert Manley came back, you know, when Howard Zinn was making these unreasonable demands, calling him the equivalent of a plantation owner. You know, here he is telling a black man this. So, you know, Manley said, well, you have produced no scholarship, which was true. He turned his book on Mayor LaGuardia he turned his dissertation into a book, and it won a prize. And I've gone through it, and it is respectable. He was capable of doing legitimate scholarship. It's very well researched and well written. But after that, he did no scholarly writing. He published in places like The Nation, including an article that just slammed where he was teaching at the time, Spelman College, and promising to make that school from a finishing school to a school for protest. So you can see why Albert Manley wanted to get rid of Howard Zinn. But it was not as easy for John Silber to do that. In fact, he couldn't get rid of him. So
he had tenure. And then we've got this lag, because if it weren't for this book that really is the centerpiece of your book, A People's History of the United States, we wouldn't even remember Howard Zinn, would we?
Probably not. I mean, he had already received some kind of or level of celebrity status as a radical for leading students on anti-Vietnam War protests, and also before that, you know, on Civil War or civil rights demonstrations. But yeah, A People's History is what launched him into rock star status as a historian.
And give us the story of that book.
Well, he was asked to write this in the late 1970s, and it came out in 1980. And I have a description about, you know, how he described his writing process.
What was it? Was it intended as a textbook or just more broadly a popular history?
It was intended as both, I believe. So, you know, it like a textbook, it doesn't have footnotes. It's got a bibliography. And I think that's part of the reason why he's gotten away with what he got away with in that book, you know, which I'd like to go into. But so he already had some notoriety and fame when he was asked to do this, you know, as a radical and as a very, very popular professor. His seminars at Boston University were always on overflow. But after it was published, it got a slow start. You know, they did a press run of 4,000. But sales kept increasing year after year. So it became a publishing phenomenon. His editor said he, in 40 years of experience, he'd never seen another book like this that sold more copies each year than it had before. So at this point, or the latest estimate I could find for 2018, was over 2.6 million copies sold, which is broken records for a book of its type. It's used in classrooms and people, you know, read it. You know, my hairdresser was telling me that, you know, he read it and he liked it.
Was a substantial portion of those sales textbook adoptions or course adoptions?
Yes, a good part were. I don't have the exact statistics on those, but
what that means is this book has been one of the most influential works in the instruction of Americans broadly in the history of their own country.
Yes, I think it's fair to say that just by the popularity. As you mentioned, the Zinn Education Project, that was started by one of his former students from the 1970s. It's a nonprofit. Teachers can go there, download lessons that are adapted from his book. They do all kinds of activism. Teachers go there to learn how they and their students can abolish Columbus Day. There are also excerpts of A People's History in other books. I went to the library, you know, I was checking out all the books I could get for each chapter. And one of the Vietnam books that I got from my little library here in Clinton, New York, was a book for middle school students, a kind of a textbook. And it has extended passages from Howard Zinn's book.
Middle school.
Yes, yes. And there are materials beginning in, I think, kindergarten that people can get from the Zinn Education Project. There are spin-off books. So Howard Zinn, you know, he did quite well financially for himself.
I think you say that by the end, he was pulling in about $200,000 a year off that book.
Yes, yes.
Not bad.
I know, you know, right?
Well, now another thing you bring out about the popularity of the book, which may have given it a big kick, was the movie Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, so... Right. If people remember that movie or have seen it, I actually met a student up here who learned about Howard Zinn from watching that movie. But Matt Damon, who was the star, was actually the Zinn's next door neighbor.
And the scene in the movie where it comes up is Matt Damon, who is this working class kid who's, you know, a 200 IQ genius. Does he see the book on the shelf of the therapist he's talking to, or?
No, he sees a multi-volume history of the United States, troubled 20-year-old. And he looks at it, and then he tells his psychiatrist, you know, if you want to read a real history book, read Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States. It will knock you on your, you know what. So Zinn's book gets the endorsement of a genius very prominently in that award-winning movie. That made, you know, sales even bigger, really, you know, made Zinn a more of a celebrity than he was.
Right. And one thing, when a book starts getting assigned in courses, it tends to keep going. You know, teachers, they do what they're familiar with and accustomed to, and what they want to do year after year. And so that just keeps getting the next cohort. And it just kind of, you know, becomes sedimented in what the United States is in terms of its past. Now, you note that many historians, both on the right and the left, have sharply criticized the book as a hack polemic. Some of them called it that. Others just say it's so tendentious in terms of coming from the left that it really, you know, misleads. It distorts the historical record, but its popularity continues. It hasn't waned. Why does A People's History of the United States stick 40 years after its publication?
Yeah, well, you know, it's also being used in education schools. So future teachers are getting their view of history from Howard Zinn. Sometimes it's the only history book that they're exposed to when they're learning about American history. So they think that it's true, and they pass it on to their students. Zinn, besides, you know, plagiarizing, lying, leaving out critical information, uses this very seductive emotional appeal through his writing. He presents himself as this kind of hero. U.S. history is a kind of grand conspiracy. All these things that he is revealing, he says, have never been told before, which is a complete lie. Of course, it's just this awful, horrible picture, the kind of picture you'd expect a communist to want a reader to have.
Right. And it begins, and Zinn, I guess, brought this up many times, the very first powerful thing about it was his version of Christopher Columbus. What was that?
Well, Christopher Columbus committed genocide. You know, the Indians came up with gifts and food, but Columbus only wanted gold. And Columbus enslaved them when they couldn't produce enough gold. Their hands were chopped off. They were worked to death. They died off. And Zinn is plagiarizing from a fellow comrade in the anti-Vietnam War movement his name was Hans Koning. And the book that Hans Koning had written was a thin paperback for high school students. And Koning himself was not a historian, he was a novelist. And what he wrote was a screed, and the first several pages of Zinn's book are plagiarized from it. And I put, you know, several passages side by side in my own book and referenced the pages of Zinn's book where they're taken from Koning. But there's one example I'd like to give here. This is from Columbus's diary, and this is Zinn's sentence, and he's speaking about the Arawaks. He says, "They would make fine servants," with ellipses, "with 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want."
So this is Zinn quoting Columbus's diaries, but there's an ellipsis between the first and the second remark.
Exactly. Normally, you would think that there was only a phrase or a sentence, possibly two, that was left out. But what Zinn does is he leaves out 2 days' worth of diary entries. And he leaves out critical information like this sentence that appears in those 2 days. "I know that they are a people who can be made free and converted to our holy faith more by love than by force." So if you read that sentence, you understand that Christopher Columbus had good intentions for the Indians. He did this as part of his Christian mission. also that first sentence that I read where he says they would make fine servants, that is probably alluding to the conversation he is having regarding another tribe that wants to take over this tribe and their opinion of them because they are so meek and amenable that they would make fine servants for them. So what you get from Zinn's very selective and dishonest editing is the opposite impression of what Zinn really wrote in his diary.
What Columbus really wrote, yeah.
Yes, I'm sorry, Columbus, thank you.
Yeah, well, you mention a little later in the book, in one section called Howard Zinn's, quote, usable Indian. What was Howard Zinn's usable Indian?
Oh, Howard Zinn's usable Indian was, it was actually being practiced quite a bit by the late 70s. And that was sort of the Marxist view of the Indian as the person living the idyllic nature, loving lifestyle. People shared, the women were empowered. They were feminists before their time. You know, it was a matrilineal society, so much more advanced than the Europeans who came here, the capitalists, you know, and of course this was used in Marxist theory, but Zinn really, really ramps it up and he paints the Indians in these broad strokes of, you know, they all, you would think, you know, that they're just farming.
And one unified people instead of, you know, dozens, hundreds of tribes, some of whom were making war upon one another.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Enslaving each other, kidnapping, killing the men, torturing them to death, and then sometimes, you know, eating them, cooking them or eating them, you know.
And so this is Zinn's version of the Columbus, you know, the first landing. What is Zinn's version of the American Revolution and of the founding of our country?
Well, that this was just a bunch of rich white men getting together, setting up a government to, you know, that was designed to enrich themselves and their class. They do allow for the small shopkeepers, the independent farmers, the middle class, but that's only to keep the downtrodden lower working classes quiet, you know, so they're a buffer. And so this is all done with the intention of, you know, keeping the upper class rich. Wars are waged because that focuses people's attention. It keeps their attention off of their own impoverishment and exploitation. And, that's pretty much the version. It's the same version that William Z. Foster gives in his own 1951 history that was published by international publishers, the CPUSA publishing house here. So it's the standard Marxist version of this sort of Garden of Eden that was here. And then the capitalists came in, they exploited the slaves, the Indians to enrich themselves and started a revolution and set up this form of government just for the purpose of keeping themselves, you know, on top.
All right. So Mary, as we wrap up here, we've seen how this version of American guilt has become widespread, especially among the younger generations, and that it is part of their instruction in American guilt. And Zinn is one of the gods of that education. How long can that go on? I mean, if you've got a generation raised on American guilt, a generation that doesn't feel patriotism, that doesn't acknowledge a country's errors, as every empire has, as every powerful nation has, but still love that country, I'm not sure how that country can survive. Over time, I don't see how that country can defend itself, which may be one of Howard Zinn's aims.
Oh, absolutely. That was his aim. Every time you finish a page in his book, you get the sense that no matter what the United States did in terms of rectifying past wrongs, civil rights, women's rights, etc., it will never do justice to the victims. Every effort, as he presents it, fails. The only option left is to overthrow the government. And Zinn makes a point of saying that peaceful protest doesn't work, legal reforms don't work. He loves it when there's blood flowing in the streets. He celebrates rioting. He celebrates the abolitionist John Brown, you know.
Did someone like Zinn, you know, young communist formed during the Depression, who saw capitalism as an evil and saw the United States going down, the Soviet Union, as the future of planet Earth, you could believe that in 1937. That was possible, you know, before the Hitler-Stalin Pact, we'll put it that way. But by 1980, one had to wonder, I mean, what kind of vision, what did they really think was going to happen if the capital system, the market system, and the form of representative government republic that we have, did they really envision concretely a replacement, or was this more a kind of, you know, Dionysian vision of the country descending into chaos?
Well, it's hard to tell what Howard Zinn thought was going to happen. And as you know, the New Left really didn't have any plans. So, you know, of an alternative government. So Howard Zinn has made these statements about, you know, being a socialist, democratic socialist, and an anarchist. So he presents this vision of somehow spontaneously, when this capitalist system is overthrown, there's going to be this indigenous movement, and people will live in harmony. They'll share everything. It's a fantasy. And, you know, does he believe it, or is it a ploy to lure young people? And it's exactly what people in Antifa believe too, by the way. So what was his plan? I don't know. He was in favor of communism, but it served his own selfish purposes very well. I mean, in terms of his own enrichment and popularity and the adulation he was given and is still given, he profited from that. But he very clearly in his book points to socialism or communism as the system that needs to be put in place in order to right all these horrible, horrible wrongs that the United States continues to perpetrate.
Well, we'll see 10 years from now where Howard Zinn and the instruction in U.S. history stands. But for now, thank you, Mary. The book is Debunking Howard Zinn, Mary Graybar. It's out with Renury. Thank you very much.
Thank you.